Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
This week,
we're going to talk about the Great Repeal Bill, not the Great Repeal Bill anymore, not even a repeal bill, but the EU Withdrawal Bill.
We build bunkers to prepare for our new Rees-Mogg overlords.
And you ask us, what is the best election to rewatch? Let's talk about Brexit, Stephen.
Woohoo!
Yeah, I want to talk about the Great Repeal Bill, which, if you're listening to this on Thursday, has started its stately, well, it's continuing its stately passage through the House of Commons. It's currently at the stage
it's
known
actually
as
the EU Withdrawal Bill now.
Yes, because you're not allowed to put adjectives in bills. One of the things I think that we learned about this.
So there are a couple of reasons why the Commons clerks were like, no, mate, you can't call it that.
Otherwise, everything would be called like the Super Amazing Prisons Bill.
Yeah, like one, they're just like, they are very, very keen to prevent sort of
the Peter Bone is a massive lad bill.
Yeah, like American-style bill naming. The second is they are... It's not a... You know, it doesn't...
It's actually not a repeal bill.
It doesn't
bill.
Repeal
it's
anything.
It's like, a kind of smoosh
there
across.
There are literally so many, like, nouns for what the EU Withdrawal Bill does that are appropriate. And in what, looking back, should have been an early warning sign about just how unhinged Theresa May can be, she managed to pick literally one of the few that does not apply to the EU Withdrawal Bill.
So for anybody who hasn't got into this exciting bit of legislative fandango, we're currently at the second reading stage of the bill, which means there'll be a couple of days of debate, then a division, a vote, but which we're expecting to be relatively uncontroversial. Labour have signalled they're going to vote against it, but unlikely to be enough Tory rebels for that to be a problem. It then goes to committee stage, the best of all the stages, where people can put down amendments, they can kind of knock it about. We'll see where we're going. That's where we might expect a bit more rustling in the undergrowth, Stephen. But you've written a blog about whether or not the Tory rebels are actually going to be all mouth and no trousers.
Well, so this is the thing. If you talk to, say, a composite Labour MP, you know, let's call them like Jeremy Blair, right? It's just a name, right? And you sit down and you talk to this person and they go...
I was going to go for Wes Phillips.
I mean, actually, I realise a composite Labour MP would be incredibly confused about what they think about the EU. Let's imagine you're talking to a composite pro-European Labour MP. So you're talking to like a weird...
Ben Hoey.
Yeah, a weird like combination of Ben Bradshaw and Emma Dencode, right? So they're very clear on what they feel about the EU, but very confused about how they feel about Tony Blair, right? And basically, their complaint isn't the average Conservative MP who they agree with on the European Union is, as one of them did put it to me, they're like, they're incredibly loud in the pages of the Times, they are incredibly silent in the chamber. So, you know, Anna Soubry will go on the Today programme and go, you know, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, Theresa May. Theresa May will just be like, you what, fam? And Anna Soubry will go, by come and have a go, I meant I will, of course, vote with you. On the Conservative side, their take is, well, look, actually, there are about 100 Labour MPs plus the leader of the Labour Party who are all fairly hard Brexity, whether through conviction or because they want their constituents to stop kvetching at them about the free movement of people. So why on earth should I stick my head up above this particular parapet when my vote is going to be sort of completely ignored by one of your guys? Now, the interesting thing about the EU Withdrawal Bill is because Labour's position has softened slightly and because they are going to oppose the Henry VIII clauses, which are... let's talk about those in a second.
I've got big love for the Henry VIII clauses.
But because Labour's decided to oppose it at second reading, we actually will get an idea of how big the chunk of Labour MPs who will vote in the most Eurosceptic way possible regardless of what the leadership tells them to do is.
Well, that'd be really interesting, because what Labour leave was about 12 or so MPs. It was kind of roughly a dozen, including, you know, people you would obviously think of like Kate Hoey and
Kelvin Hopkins, Frank Field.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see who else is going to stay with them. But yeah, let's talk Henry VIII, because, so tell me if I've got this right, a Henry VIII clause. In order, basically, because it's not repealing EU legislation, what this bill is doing is seamlessly moving a huge amount of EU legislation into British law, with the idea that then you will have to kind of unpick things afterwards.
Yeah.
What it needs to do in order to do that is grant ministers a great deal more power in order to, where, for example, in a bill it says, you know, the kind of European Commission, they can sort of cross it out and write in British government. However, there's allegedly a kind of sunset clause on this that you say it's all of these powers expire 2 years from exit date, but you're also allowed to move the exit date. And I think from the very informative Wikipedia page on the EU withdrawal bill, I found out that Dominic Cummings, one of the big architects of Vote Leave, has actually criticised the Henry VIII clauses, because technically you could use them to undo the entirety of the bill and indeed EU withdrawal, right? It is an enormous amount of power to put into the hands of their further, like, unscrutinised then into the hands of ministers.
Yeah, so basically, if it passes as is, and the interesting thing is, other than Dominic Cummings, I am yet to encounter a leaver who's gone, wait a second, if there is an establishment plot to have a soft Brexit at the 11th hour, this is a brilliant mechanism to do it. Yeah, brief diversion. I am surprised, considering how frightened the average Tory MP is of Jeremy Corbyn, how they are also still concomitantly relaxed about incredibly authoritarian measures and things which increase executive overreach. If I were as worried about Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister as the average Tory MP, you better believe I would be even more in love with the ECJ and judicial oversight than I am already. I just find it remarkable that that has triggered no rethinking at all. But the thing is, you then use statutory instruments and the like to change things instead of kind of...
Which are kind of essentially just like a proclamation, really, more rather than a full-blown legislative
kind of
method.
And it does make it... Because it's faster, it makes it harder for sort of, you know, troublesome backbenchers or opposition MPs to go, hang about, why are you doing this? And there is a slight problem that you do have to have some way of not forcing Parliament to have a vote every time you want to go, I know how it says, and this regulation will be enforced by the Commission, but actually it's going to be enforced by the new UK quango for...
Well, that
food,
is, but that
hygiene.
It does lead you to a really interesting point, right? Which is that this bill essentially anticipates the creation of a huge number of scrutinising and regulatory bodies, which currently don't exist. And as far as I can see, you don't have a massive plans yet to exist, because that's still part of the negotiation. They've just published the science policy papers this week, and basically the science policy papers say we would basically like it just to be like it is now, if that's possible. In fact, what maybe we'd like it to have, like, closer cooperation than the EU currently has with any non-EU state. So like what we've got now, and if not that, then a better deal than literally anyone else has got. And I think Rob Hutton Bloomberg tweeted it, was saying, well, it's unsurprising that they haven't kind of come out to do any questions on this, because there are no answers to the questions of, you know, it is so obvious from that the position is, we really wish we weren't leaving the EU. Make it, like, as much like being in the EU as possible, please.
On the kind of science stuff, right, there is a really strong incentive for the idea that you continue to pay in and everyone benefits from having a frictionless research border. The difficulty is...
Because that's the thing, isn't it? Most scientific research projects now are multidisciplinary and, well, not multidisciplinary, but international. Something like CERN has got something like 40 countries that are involved in that, right? If we kind of unilaterally did that, funding would be such a massive, massive problem for scientific research.
The difficulty, though, with that sort of general Brexit attitude, right, is our listeners will have noticed this new kind of brain worm that's going around bits of the right, going, we need to call their bluff and go for no deal. Actually, no deal, it's not just catastrophic, it's actually unimaginable. It's one of those things where no one can describe what it's like without actually describing a deal.
I had exactly that argument on Sunday night on Five Live with Ruth Lee, who is a pretty sane Brexiteer, who said, I wish I hadn't put the £350 million on the bus. You know, that was obviously a lie. And you were like, oh, are we allowed to say that? How exciting. But, you know, I said, what about, I know one of your obsessions, the Open Skies Agreement, right? I said, what is the government's plan if there is no deal for getting anguished pensioners home from Alicante? You know, she said, well, I know, how do they get home from Switzerland? I said, Because they have a deal. Like, yeah. Like, it's a different deal, but they still have it. Like, they still have a deal.
But crucially, yeah, one, everything all nation states do either hinges on deals or warfare, right? And there is really no middle ground, right?
Well, that's cheery. Like, thanks for that.
There's deals, warfare, or it not happening, right? Those are your options, right? But the other problem is the UK government isn't even prepared for, you know, let's say a good but patchy deal, right? A deal with even the same number of gaps as the EU-Canada deal, right? Generally seen as quite a good, you know, like, relatively non-acrimonious for
which
a trade
took,
deal.
Like 7 years to,
yeah,
to
and
do?
It's, but also kind of, yeah, one which, like, broadly both sides are quite happy with, right? That deal, the UK government is not at the moment big enough to deal with the responsibilities that would involve coming home, right? The UK government is not staffed up to deal with more customs inquiries or more border inquiries. The UK government is not staffing up to do its own food hygiene checks about whether or not beef from Argentina is safe, right? It is, you know, all of these things that the EU does for it currently, the UK is very much not actually. This idea of, like, we can prepare for no deal, it's like the British government isn't even adequately preparing for many plausible deals and could emerge from the process. I mean, I think with the ability of ministers to change things without having to consult Parliament, there are lots of ways you could do that. For example, provided you could have a stipulation about like-for-like changes, right? There are lots of reasons why it's a waste of our time and money, and we've decided that we are probably going to have a situation where we continue to pay some money to the EU for access, but we also pay for our own people to go round and poke meat in an abattoir somewhere in South America. However, no one thinks it's unreasonable to go, okay, instead of you having to get a kite mark from this European Commission body, you have to get it from, like, the British Department of International Beef. People do think it's unreasonable for you to be able to change workers' rights, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. So there are lots of things the government could do to soften it. But the big question is, yes, whether or not Tory MPs will actually, when it comes to committee stage, put their money where their red box column is.
And and one of the things that some of the harder right Tory MPs keep doing that is not very helpful is popping up to say, one, that we'll be able to get rid of all that pesky red tape, which is exactly the thing that they should not be doing, because when they say red tape, people on the other side hear maternity pay, you know, ability not to be boiled in oil.
I mean, that is actually what people... Well, no. That's both unfair and slightly too fair. It's unfair to say that when people say that, they mean maternity leave. On the whole, they don't actually mean that, because on the whole, what they're saying is brainless, right? But, actually, if you look at most red tape and regulation, you are talking about environmental protections.
Yeah. Look at America. If you want any kind of vision of what less red tape means, look at the states which are currently underwater, but they've slashed funding to the Environmental Protection Agency. Look at the fact that most states don't have any federally mandated maternity leave, so some American women have to use their holiday entitlement in order to go off and give birth. I mean, one of the weirdest moments of the whole campaign with me was going to the Women for Brexit launch and hearing, like, a weird video of Priti Patel talking about how the suffragettes would have voted for Brexit. I didn't want to go, quite a few of the suffragettes were fascist, so this might not be quite the thing you want to go for. But this whole idea that actually, yeah, that this bonfire of red tape will be a good thing for women, will be a good thing for workers, will be a good thing for the environment, is for the birds. See, that's me using a Stephen Bushism.
So, are you hashtag I'm with him?
Oh, God, don't. It makes me so, so upset. So, Jacob Rees-Mogg has had quite the
Captain
week.
Captain Leader Legend.
Don't. I'm holding you personally responsible. Anoush and I will have to come around and put a horse's head in your bed when he becomes Prime Minister. So, there was a story in the Times on Monday morning about Theresa May's likely cabinet reshuffle, which she seems to be holding out as the kind of sword of Damocles that will get her through the conference season without too many obvious noises off. And it had some good mentions in there about people who might be promoted. For example, Johnny Mercer, who I've been on a panel with, and I think is a very good and thoughtful Tory backbench MP. He's done great campaigns on mental health and people leaving the armed forces. Tom Tugendhat, who quite a few of the lobby journalists on the right get very excited about. I haven't met him, so I can't offer you an opinion there. But also a mention that rising star Jacob Rees-Mogg would probably soon find himself with a high-level position. Conservative Home, which is a website for Tory activists, i.e. the both people most likely to be involved in the final stage of that leadership contest, put Jacob Rees-Mogg ahead of all the other candidates, even David Davis, although behind none of the above, essentially, as their favourite pick to succeed Theresa May. And then he was on the Daily Politics saying, well, of course, you know, you might as well, you know, offer to be Pope. I couldn't, who would offer me such a thing? You know, and also I'm such a rebel. I couldn't compromise my enormously deep principled held beliefs on Brexit. So my feeling for a long time has been that he is angling for promotion. He ran for the Treasury Select Committee and lost, was second to Nicky Morgan. And I think, yeah, I think absolutely he would want to be in the cabinet. Maybe if only to be in the cabinet to flounce out of it in a big Brexit-related huff at some point.
But I mean, also, yeah, like, oh, you know, I can't remember who the origin of quote, though. Just like, you know, if any 100 MPs, 82 of them want to be Prime Minister, right? And 50 of them believe they could become Prime Minister, right? Which is one of the reasons why getting them to agree on anything is so difficult. Obviously, Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, socially conservative, in many ways the sort of avatar of lots of things that the average NS podcast listener dislikes about the Conservative Party, has a tricky path to becoming Tory leader. Assuming he is brought into the to ministerial rank in the next reshuffle, which I think is likely, partly because if I were in Downing Street and I wanted to extend Theresa May's lifespan, you need to show people that she is going to try and do a Michael Howard style, bringing in the kind of possible leadership candidate.
And also it will smother him very effectively. He won't be able to go on TV and have thoughts about whatever he wants to have thoughts on. He's going to have thoughts about whatever incredibly dull brief they give him. Like, yeah. CF, poor old Michael Gove and Defra.
It is a good way of, like, neutering people who can otherwise be difficult. Yeah, and obviously under the Conservative system, because some pundits are going like, oh, Corbyn shows anything can happen, which is a bit like going, oh, Trump shows Le Pen can win. It's just like, well, Trump would have lost under any other presidential system in the world.
Yeah. But so, I do think that the way the Tory leadership contest is structured actually means Rees-Mogg could win, right?
Yes. I mean, so if you imagine a composite Tory MP, let's call them Philip Hammond. Wait, that's a real MP.
Philip
Rudd, right?
That's a bit Remainy, isn't it? No, it should be... What about Liam Rudd?
Liam Rudd, right? You sit down with Liam Rudd, right? And you talk to them about the next leadership election. They go, oh, I quite like Amber. She's good. Shame about the majority, though. And then depending on how much they like Amber, they might go, but, you know, we could just... Yeah, we're the Tory party. She could just be like, I've always loved Holland and the Deepings. And it would all be fine. But they might, if they're a bit on the right, go, oh, you know, Dominic Raab is good. But then the average Tory MP will go, the important thing is we have to make sure that none of the following get through to the membership. And then they say...
Boris Johnson,
Andrea Leadsom, Rees-Mogg, and Dominic Raab, right? And if you think about the last Conservative leadership election, where Theresa May basically became the safe haven for Liberal Conservatives because they thought, oh, she gave that nasty party speech, she'll be one of us, right? In one of those,
I'm sure the vans were just an oversight, really. I mean, who hasn't issued go-home vans?
Well, I think the thing is a lot of Cameroon-inclined Conservatives were like, Cameron occasionally did things that made me uncomfortable like that, but he didn't mean it, right? Mm-hmm. And then it was just like, oh, no, it turns out she completely meant that, right? But so she was able to reach out to large chunks of the right of the party and basically became the safe haven for the left of the party, right? But Andrea Leadsom still got 86 votes in the final reckoning. So if you think about the fact in the next Tory leadership election, when they throw that final two down to the membership, will be Amber Rudd and not Amber Rudd. And then the members will go, not electing this pro-European communist. And then they will pick not Amber Rudd, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, someone said that one of the things that's a crucial factor in the Tory leadership candidate is the Daily Mail, which is the newspaper read by people of the same demographic who are Tory activists, right?
Yeah.
Who you can see them... You know, Quentin Letts, I can't remember exactly which century exactly it was, but said, you know, Rees-Mogg is the candidate, you know, he's the honourable member for either the 18th century or the early 19th century. It was a century that is a previous century, is what I'm saying. But they, you know, they probably like his hardline views on abortion. They can spin his Catholicism as just being kind of very traditionalist value, right? You are not going to get a searing indictment of his values there in the kind of the newspaper of choice of Tory activists.
My instinct is the next Conservative leader will be to Theresa May's right, just because of the kind of parliamentary arithmetic. I think Rees-Mogg's chances have receded significantly because he's become more of a thing. But basically, of those four candidates who Philip Rudd wants to stop, it's just about mathematically plausible that you end up with a situation where...
You can't stop all of them.
Where
the Tory right only has to be lucky once.
Yeah, they only have to be lucky once. You only have to sort of mess up when you're trying to, you know, because there was lots of...
I mean, we were very lucky, really, that Michael Gove detonated Boris Johnson. Otherwise, really, that could very well have... He could be Prime Minister right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think Boris Johnson would be better for the Brexit process than Theresa May, but...
Ooh, okay, well, we'll come back to that cheeky little hot take later in some future podcast. What I was writing about was the kind of media attitude to it. And I think, you know, obviously it's fine. And he's been on Good Morning Britain this week. And actually, that's where the latest quotes about him saying, you know, even in cases of rape, he's opposed to abortion. He's against gay marriage because he's a very traditionalist Catholic. And you might say those are his private views and he's entitled to them, which I entirely agree they are and he is. However, his voting record is also on that measure as well. And I think for abortion particularly, there are quite a few other big voices who keep quite quiet about it. Like Jeremy Hunt, for example, wants a reduction in the time limit. Maria Miller has previously talked about a reduction in the time limit. You can see a kind of easy, like a chipping away of that kind of stuff that the progressive side has been used to thinking was a settled argument, and it could very quickly not become a settled argument again. So my big contention about it is the sort of lol, look at his monocle stuff is really bad, because if there's one lesson from the 2017 election you want to take, it's the way that the Tories treated Jeremy Corbyn as a joke right up to the moment they tried to convince you he was basically a paramilitary communist who was going to turn us into Venezuela and bring back the three-day week and have, you know, rubbish bags piling up in Trafalgar Square. And you were like, but how can this guy be dangerous when you were saying he was, you know, a complete joke only 6 months ago? And you can't say that someone's pathetic and weak and weaselly and then in the next breath turn around and say they're a monster and they must be stopped, which is exactly the same thing that happened with Trump. He was just this yahoo who was invited on stuff. And people get into this, I know I talked about this before, the kind of the post-gaff paddock, right? Where actually the gaffes have been so, or gaffes or bad opinions or whatever you want to call them, have been so thoroughly digested and still are not a barrier to their candidacy that they then lose all potency. And it's just sort of accepted that that's what that person thinks about that. So, not funny. That's what I'm saying. Jacob Rees-Mogg.
It's not big and it's not clever.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So things can only get better, Stephen, and that's why in this week's You Ask Us, I'm going to ask a question on behalf of myself, which is, what's the best election to rewatch? I rewatched 1997, which was screened by BBC Parliament this week, and it had some amazing moments in it. First of all,
on a work day?
No, I watched it in the evening. I came home watching the evening, which was just, I got home and had finished cooking dinner by the time it got to Tony Blair emerging from his house in Islington. And it was just, I mean, it reminds you that 1997 is another country, right? They had a whole bit where David Imbe said, of course, Tony Blair's talked about sending his kids to the school in the oratory and how disgusted and concerned he feels about them having to get the bus to school past so many homeless people in King's Cross. And you were like, yeah, King's Cross used to be incredibly, incredibly shitty. And also, do you remember that time about a couple of years ago when we didn't have quite so many homeless people in London and now they're all back again? Yeah, that was one of the things that the Labour government did, is it cut rough sleeping. And then he arrived at the palace and there was a whole thing about whether or not his agenda was radical enough, and they were talking to James Callaghan and Neil Kinnock, and he was saying, well, actually, I think James Callaghan was saying, well, actually his agenda is quite radical, for example, House of Lords reform. And I was like, wow, remember in 1997 when we had all toff, you know, like that was kind of
just
not...
like thousands of them, yeah, just like oodles and oodles of
Every person called Peregrine in the entire country was penned into the House of Lords. And New Labour... anyway, I know this is me sounding extremely like a sad bitterite, but it was a really nice election to watch because everybody that I like in British politics, I have respect for, was really, really happy. about it. And there was just real camaraderie between Kinnock and Callaghan, which was actually quite sweet to see as well. Like, everyone was being really nice to Neil Kinnock, because every so often someone would ask him a question like, hey, Neil, didn't you feel like this might have happened to you in 1992? And then he'd sort of look a bit wistful, and then we'd all reflect on how Labour lost the 1992 election when it wasn't expecting to.
So I think it's tricky to pick a favourite one, right? It's a bit like being, I imagine it's how I would feel if I was asked to pick a favourite child. Partly because they're enjoyable as mainly as part of a wider sequence, right? They are actually also great telly, which you'd expect, seeing as they are flagship programmes with a great deal of money behind them. But
the
mostly,
foreshadowing is really great, actually, when they just bring on someone that you know is going to be a big character later and you're like, oh, or a big issue. There was a great bit in the 1997 one where they talked about the fact that because all the potential candidates for the Tory leadership, apart from Ken Clark, all agreed on Europe, it wasn't going to be a big issue in this Conservative leadership contest. And you were like, oh, the Chekhov's gun is there right in the middle of the stage.
Yeah, I mean, that is the brilliant thing about elections is because particularly late on when they have to fill time and everyone's a bit tired, you will always have, sometimes from the same person, the hilariously correct in hindsight and the hilariously wrong in hindsight statement. And yeah, they're both always sort of great fun. It's a bit like you enjoyed 2017 a lot more or a lot less, I guess, depending on your perspective. If you've had to sit through 2015, you also spot interesting things by watching lots of them in a sequence, right? Now, obviously, it is well known that the Conservative 2017 election was, you know, more of a table wine, as vintages go. But you can really tell the difference between that. In both 2015 and 2017, the Conservatives knew in 2015 that things had gone well and they thought they were going to be in government, but they were not expecting to win. In 2017, they knew that things had gone poorly.
But not quite how poorly.
But they thought that it would all be all right on the night. And the other fascinating thing is in 2015, when the exit poll comes out and they get their own private returns and it's like, oh, we might, oh, we are clearly the only people who can form a government. They all are very quickly given this kind of like, what these results show is that we have clearly won and they have clearly lost. And
we're the only party that can form a government. We had the big gain. Yeah. We have a commanding lead in terms of number of seats.
And actually, on the Labour side, yes, there's that weird moment where they're like, oh, we're told we have Harriet Harman. And they're like, oh, no, we don't. Where they literally were just like, what's the line? But they did, like, once have.
And everyone in Scotland basically, like, hid in the toilet, didn't they? Because yeah. They were like, there's nothing that we can say about this that isn't just crying and screaming.
But they did have, yeah, they did eventually have their line of, this shows the coalition has lost its majority, which is a stupid line, right, in terms of sort of logic. But if your job
is 3 a.m.
If your job is to go on air and not condemn Ed Miliband, it's a brilliant line. And that is, in many ways, like, the example of why you can have a good campaign and lose. And because in 2015, both campaigns did the right thing in terms of their sort of hygiene and getting through the night. In 2017, actually, the Labour Party had the sense, you know, you sort of had, you know, Emily Thornberry, John McDonnell just being like, look, we haven't had many results yet. Who knows if this is correct? Who knows?
Yeah, John McDonnell was there for the exit poll, and he doesn't do what you imagine internally you must have been doing, which is probably what I did, which is just go for fully 10 to 15 minutes.
Whereas what did happen with the Conservatives that night is you could tell it was, yeah, I mean, obviously, you could tell it was a bad campaign for many reasons, not least the exit poll. But even by the end of the night, you still had ministers and MPs giving wildly different answers about what had gone wrong, when really you just like, you know, something like, you know, like, this has been a contentious election and we've been punished for being too honest, right?
Yeah, which is we're a divided country and that's what it's shown us. But, you know, we have made big gains in some unexpected places, for example, in Scotland.
Yeah, so that seems to it exposed in micro the problems of the overall election. I think, you know, so I haven't watched 1997 for a while.
It's really great. I mean, you will cry.
The thing is, you really have to invest in a lot of time to enjoy 1997. Because I would
have to watch all the ones from 1979 onwards.
Well, I'd say ideally you'd start from 79 to get the full thing. But you actually have to watch 1992 to get the... Partly because there are so many people who, like, their role is a direct sequel in 90... Yeah, of which the best one is the bit when they're like, Basildon, who's going to win this in 1992? And then David Amos does his weird goal celebration, and you can tell all of the Labour people are just like, oh, this is awful. And Heseltine comes on and they ask him a question about like a hung parliament. He's like, who thinks it's going to be a hung parliament? You do, but you're getting shock after shock, aren't you? As opposed to 1997, where he kind of comes on at one point looking like someone's just shot his dog.
Strangled his dog.
Strangled his dog.
Not him. the lawyers would probably want us to clarify that he did clarify he did not strangle his Alsatian.
But, you know, you enjoy them more when you have the kind of sort of...
You watch a really, really early one where there was someone going, and I look, there are some mouse have just broken into the studio, so all the ladies are on their chairs.
Oh, yeah, in 1964, no, maybe it's 50... I mean, 59 has a weird moment where they're just like... You're in that quiet period from like 10 to 11, because obviously election counts happened quicker those days because they hadn't cut local authorities to the bone. Now, this is actually true, right? That is one of the reasons why elections are getting later. And they're like, oh, you know, we thought you might be bored, so we're going to show you some pictures of like the
ladies,
the attractive
and the
ladies who are typing and helping us like crunch the numbers. And then the camera quite literally pans over the young women who are doing these sort of fairly high-tech jobs. And basically you have this thing of whatever the original Dimbleby was called, Oliver, Peter...
Richard
Dimbleby... Basically going, yeah, doing his own sort of shag, marry, kill, including the real low point of him just being like, well, get the camera away from that one. No one wants to see that. Yeah, and I'm paraphrasing, but I am not making it worse than it was.
But that's one of the things that's really astonishing at 1997. I watched a good chunk and it had David Dimbleby, it had Callahan, it had Neil Kinnock, it had Richard Attenborough, it had Jeremy Paxman, it had... possibly teenage Nick Robinson, and the only woman on that whole time was Shirley Williams, who was kind of bundled on for a minute. And it was the last... You remember just also what a big effect the quote-unquote Blair babes, but, you know, the 101 women that came in because of the all-women shortlist, just meant that you could have so many more female guests, and actually then there were so many more female commentators. I think they had Kate Adey at a count, but pretty much everyone else was a dude. It really is incredible to see just the sheer blokiness of politics in 1997, which also makes you realise how you then look again at the pictures of Tony Blair posing with his kids on the steps of Downing Street, and again, what kind of, you know, how different that felt as well. I meant to switch it on for like 5 minutes just to kind of tap in, just to sort of like, so I could laugh at some 90s interior design and terrible like Windows 96 graphics, but I stuck with it for more than an hour.
I mean, maybe you can get away with starting at 83, and they're all on YouTube. They're really good. 83's also got the best of the theme music with this great, very 80s sequence.
Well, there's some great Corbyn appearances in some of the 80s ones as well, aren't there? So that'd be good for kind of foreshadowing purposes. Anyway, if you have a favourite moment from any of the election broadcasts, why not go out and have a drink with some friends, live a little? But also send us a tweet or email.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis. It's produced by Caroline Crampton and recorded by India Bork. Our music is by the Underscore Orchestra and is licensed under Creative Commons. The New Statesman podcast is now on Twitter at @NS_podcasts. There you can suggest questions for You Ask Us. Suggest what new pop culture sensations, seriously, should cover. Send insults.
Memes to John Ellidge to John about Ellidge. Houses.
Yeah. Anyway, that's at @NS_podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.